Welcome to The Market, sponsored by the CME Group. Dateline, Scottsdale, Arizona, on Friday, November 20th. Hello again, I'm Orion Samuelson here for our weekly visit, and the markets and the world get stranger every month, every week. Who would have thought, with all of the turmoil in Europe, in Paris, in Africa, that we would end the trading week on Wall Street with the kind of strength that we did today? Because the S&P 500 scored its best week in almost a year. A solid week today. Healthcare, technology, and consumer stock market making gains, and investors looking beyond the widely expected December interest rate hike. Because in addition to all of the worldly turmoil, we also had the Federal Reserve minutes from the October meeting indicating that there will be an interest rate hike in December. That would be the first in 10 years. And despite all of that, the stock market rolled up a solid week and ended the week healthcare, technology, and consumer stocks making gains and investors looking beyond the turmoil and the widely expected December interest rate hike. The S&P 500, its strongest week in almost a year, while the Dow Industrial Average has moved out of negative territory for the year. It's now back into positive territory, higher than when the year started. The reason for that, a 5.5% jump in Nike stock today after Nike announced a $12 billion share buyback and a 2-for-1 share split. The sporting goods maker helped send the consumer discretionary sector up 1.25%, making it the top gainer among the 10 major S&P sectors. And healthcare also higher, led by allergens, 3.5% increase. The drug maker rose on reports that the U.S. Treasury's new tax inversion rules were unlikely to thwart the proposed deal that Allergan has with Pfizer. For the week, the S&P gained 3.33%, its best showing since December. The Dow went up 3.4% for the week, and the NASDAQ added 3.6%. And of course, as we look ahead to next week, trading volume will probably be light, which can lead to more volatility in the market, because there is the expectation that a lot of traders will take the entire week of Thanksgiving off and not be on the trading floor. So that is looking at a 3.5-day trading week next week. Markets will be closed all day Thanksgiving Day and will close close at noon on Friday, or Black Friday, if you want to call it that, and so that will make for a 3.5-day trading week next week. Some of the other stories in the news this week, this lawsuit's going to drag on forever. The attorneys should make a lot of money on this one. Swiss seed company Syngenta has sued top U.S. grain exporters Cargill and ADM over losses that U.S. farmers said they suffered from rejections of boatloads of genetically modified corn by China. The lawsuit, which was filed on Thursday in a U.S. district court in Kansas, comes after Cargill, ADM, and hundreds of farmers sued Syngenta last year to cover and recover damages linked to the rejections, which started in late 2013. It all centers on Syngenta's decision to sell a type of GMO corn seed called MIR-162, also known as Viterra. And they did that before obtaining import approval from China in December. And that led to the rejections and the refusal of the Chinese government to accept boatloads of the GMO corn. Syngenta, the world's top crop chemical company, said it was not responsible for losses incurred by traders or farmers But if anyone is responsible, the company said, it is the exporters that shipped GMO corn to China without approval. ADM said no comment on the lawsuit, but Cargill spokesman said Syngenta's commercialization practices and conduct are responsible for the industry damage. And so Syngenta said in its lawsuit that Cargill and ADM failed to keep MIR 162 corn separated from approved strains, even though they should have known the strain was not approved by China. So whose fault is it? Well, Syngenta says it's the fault of the export companies, and the export companies so are saying, no, Syngenta should have not sold the seed until they had that import approval from China. Quite a go-around, and it's not going to be over quickly, I can assure you of that. The other business in the agricultural community this week, Tyson Foods, the number one meat processor in the United States, said this week it will stop operations at two of its plants in the United States. That means about 880 employees will be out of work, the company said. It expects to cease operations at a plant in Jefferson, Wisconsin, making pepperoni, and a plant in Chicago, where they produce prepared foods. And the closures would affect 480 employees in Chicago, about 400 in Jefferson, Wisconsin. And Tyson Foods said it was happening because of a change in the product lineup. Well, at the Farm Broadcasters Convention in Kansas City this month, I had the opportunity to sit down and visit with Tim Andreessen. Tim Andreessen, who is the managing director of agricultural commodities at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. We haven't talked to Tim for a while, and so my first question to Tim is, what about the market and how active is the market? And what about market volume?
We've continued to see growth in the markets. You know, a lot of that growth is coming internationally. A great example of that is we spent a lot of time in the Black Sea region, in the Ukraine, particularly in the last couple of years. And, you know, one of the things we've seen that just cements why our futures contracts are so important is, you know, they're now trading corn in the Black Sea basis Chicago Board of Trade futures. So, you know, if you go to one of the merchants there and you ask for a quote on a vessel, they're going to now quote it as, you know, X dollars or cents over the CBT futures. So, you know, we continue to get this growth as more and more people see our markets as the benchmark and start to use them as a hedging mechanism.
Do you find farmers continue to use the market for hedging?
We do. We still see them as, you know, developing their marketing skills.
Right.
You know, that's been a big thing. I mean, you've been around this business for a long time, and you've seen that evolution.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot more tools out there that they could use that they still are not using. One of the areas we've seen a lot of growth in is in options. And in particular, several years ago, we launched what we call short-dated new crop options.
Right.
And this has probably been the most successful product that we've launched in quite some time in the agricultural space, because it allows a producer to still have the same kind of protection as a regular option, but for a smaller window of time, which in turn means that his overall cost is less.
Right.
So as a producer, you may say, look, I really want to get some protection. I don't know what the market's going to do, but I just want to see, I want protection through when the crop emerges. So instead of buying that option on the December futures that expires in November, I'm going to buy something that, you know, expires in, you know, May or June or something like that. And if I get there and I still want more protection, I can just buy, you know, another one. And the cost, though, of that option that expires in, say, May is substantially different than that option that expires in November.
So as manager of agricultural products, How do you decide what new contracts you are going to bring on to the market? Does it come from possible customers who say, we need this, or how do you go about that?
Almost all of the ideas we have are driven by customers. Okay. It's by, you know, spending time with customers, understanding what their needs are, understanding their business. We've got a fantastic team, both on the product development side and on the research side, who spend a lot of time talking to customers. You know, circling back, you know, the short-dated new crop options came from customers saying, I love the idea of an option, but it's expensive.
Yeah.
So we really try to embrace that feedback and, you know, make sure that the products that we're offering fit a specific need. And the other thing we do a lot of is simply working on the products we have and making sure that they continue to become continue to be the most effective hedging tools for producers and for other market participants.
And I also see that you're constantly working on security to raise the trust level of producers in the country, particularly who say, what kind of a game is this? But you're working on that all the time.
Yeah, we have a significant investment in ensuring the integrity of our markets. I mean, the most important thing to us is to have markets that people believe in and have that integrity. You know, we have a market reg team that is, you know, very, very focused on ensuring they understand what's going on in the market. And,
right.
you know, Orion, one of the things about electronic trading is you have a perfect understanding of what everybody's doing. Every bid, every offer, every order is electronic. So there's a perfect audit trail of when it went in, when it came out. You know, using the tools that we have is really important to us to make sure that people have confidence in the markets.
So the future of the futures market, including options, pretty bright.
We think so. We think we're an important part of the food value chain. You know, we have big challenges facing us in terms of feeding the population, a growing population in the world. And, you know, if you think about that value chain, the producer on one end and the consumer on the other end and everything in between, you know, we're very efficient at that. But to maintain that efficiency, supporting that, what you need is you need a risk management support function. You need to take those costs that normally would become part of the food driven by risk out. And, you know, using the futures markets as a tool to manage price risk is one of the things that can help maintain an efficient value chain and to help reduce some of the cost of food prices.
A visit with Tim Andreessen, who always has some interesting information for us, and he is the manager of the agricultural commodities at the CME Group, and we look forward to the next time we can sit down and talk to Tim. Max Armstrong is joining us on the show in a very short time, as we talk markets with Arlen Suderman of the INTLFC Stone Group. So stand by. That'll come right after this from the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need, today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Well, the markets on Wall Street were indeed intriguing this week with all of the global activity. And there was also some interesting activity in the commodity markets. So right now, let's sit down with Max Armstrong and his guest and talk markets.
Well, Orion, as you know, we've seen the last official crop production estimates for 2015 that'll be released this year with that November crop report that came out a few days ago. We'll get the final production numbers and the January report. But I sat down the other day with the chief commodities economist for INTLFC Stone, Arlen Suderman, and asked him to look back at that report that came out earlier this month, and whether or not he was surprised by the fact that there were higher production numbers for the corn and soybean crops in the U.S.
Not really. Now, I had a lower yield estimate earlier in the year as we looked at anecdotal yield evidence coming in, but my study of history of USDA is once they get the October report, This goes back to 1994 when they changed their methodology. They've had a pretty good record. So once, if they raise their yield estimate in October, they're probably going to raise it in November. Now, the increase that USDA gave us was at the top end of that historical range, but it was still within that range, and suggests that we could see a little bit more strength going into the January report as well, although the tendency is not quite as strong. So the supply wasn't really a surprise. Now I think we need to focus on the demand side and what we can do with these prices to try to build demand.
But both corn and beans could yet ratchet up a little bit more for the final report in January?
They absolutely could, and which is amazing to what we're doing with the genetics these days when you consider the adversity that these crops went through, particularly in southern and eastern parts of the Midwest through the first half of the growing season. Absolutely amazing the size of the crop we were able to produce.
But weren't you getting a number of reports from growers pretty much along that line, those anecdotal reports saying, hey, you know what, we're kind of pleasantly surprised here?
Well, we were seeing that, but we were also seeing a lot of reports of problems, particularly in southern and eastern areas. And so it was just hard to conceive that we could have this big of a crop with that big of an area having problems. We were also anticipating that the late planted soybeans would struggle to hit the yield goals. But yet the yields just kind of held up even in the late harvest, and that was pretty impressive on the crop.
One would think that as we see this developing over time, the markets would become less sensitive to these weather gyrations, that it would be more taken in stride. Will that in fact happen?
Yeah, it really will. And, you know, we're looking at some possibility of adverse weather next year, depending on the and when El Nino peaks and the speed of the transition back toward cooler sea surface temperatures, whether it's going to be favorable or not. But right now we're looking at a more favorable spring at this point. So that means that any type of adverse weather probably, if it does happen, is going to be held off to summer. And so it's going to be difficult to get the trade to get too concerned if nothing happens in South America until probably at least June or July. So that means that we're going to struggle in here. The basis market's going to have to try to pull the grain out of the hands of farmers, which they don't want to let go. I understand that. It's probably going to be more of a basis market rally if we get one, more than the board.
And it's trying to do that, is it not, in the eastern corn belt especially?
Yeah, and that still is a corn deficit area, to some extent a soybean deficit area. So we're trying to pull the grain to the east, and that's difficult to do, but the cash market's working on doing that. And we have good grind margins, profitable grind margins on ethanol, and good crush margins for soybeans because the soy meal demand is strong. And so that's giving the incentive to do so. And it's just going to take some more work to do. A lot of farmers want to see a 4 in front of the corn and a 10 in front of the soybeans, and they're stubborn enough to try to hold out for it.
Since you mentioned South America quickly, there is no production problem at the moment, is there?
No, in a typical El Nino season, you'll see wetter conditions south above trend yields and below normal precip to the north and below trend yields. And we're seeing that rainfall pattern at this point. But normal in Mato Grosso is 6 to 8 inches per month. That's more than what the crop needs. And we're seeing timely enough rains right now that there's really no legitimate threat to the crop at this point, other than a few isolated areas.
Again, our guest this weekend is Arlen Suderman from INTLFC Stone. Arlen, again, let's go back to the reports that came out earlier this month. USDA did some numbers juggling there, and they threw out some assumptions that had been held, especially in regard to Chinese demand, right?
Well, in the biggest surprise, I will say, in the market can be anticipated, and that's the big adjustment on China. We were receiving some information out of our China office that we could maybe anticipate some of the adjustments and changes, and I think it explains some of the policy changes we're seeing there. But basically showing Chinese stocks much bigger than previously anticipated. In fact, if you look at the adjustment on the balance sheet, basically a tenth the size of the crop upward in supplies. And so China's implementing policies to try to shut down the alternative grains coming in so that farmers or so that end users use the big corn reserve that they have. They're looking at subsidizing end users using those big reserve corn. And so we're probably going to shut down, or at least not shut down, slow down imports of U.S. grain sorghum, and a lot of farmers geared up their production this year for that market. So the basis market's collapsing for grain sorghum. That's pushing more grain sorghum into ethanol. That's displacing corn. All of those factors were put into the balance sheet without any forewarning from USDA. So it was a surprise to many. It makes the corn balance sheet more bearish, probably is a little bit more supportive grain sorghum basis in the near term for those plains farmers who are growing it. They did raise the demand for soybeans, and I thought that was very positive. I think China will continue to surprise USDA with their buying power there. That's historically, USDA has trouble pegging the Chinese demand. So the demand is there for soybeans, but the crop is there as well. The demand is softer on corn. We're really not that big on domestic or global stocks, but we live in a just-in-time type of a market, and until we have a threat to the corn supply, there's no reason for futures to sustain a rally.
What's the basis for this situation in China, the need to readjust? Do they have fewer animal units than we thought?
That's part of it, but really goes back to 2008, 2009, when we were experiencing the ethanol boom here. We're experiencing high global prices. A lot of countries made some bad policy decisions back then, including China, put the subsidy price at $9 to $9.50 for corn, encouraged a lot of production. Overproduction is what it ended up being. Their pork producers, which is their primary livestock industry, couldn't afford $9 corn and started selling sows. And the number one fear in China and the government is social unrest. And food inflation is the number one driver of social unrest, and pork is the number one driver of food inflation. And so as the hog numbers started to decline, that's when Chinese government started getting worried and started thinking, we've got to push this corn, get this down to affordable level to encourage expansion in the hog industry once again. And so that's really the driving factor behind it right now.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the possibility in your mind that we might see any price improvement here over the course of the winter. What's your gut feeling of that for corn and soybeans?
I think what we're going to see overall in the commodities is carving out a broad multi-year low and then slowly rebuilding things. That's assuming there's no weather scare in the southern hemisphere in that period of time. Basis, I think, will be stronger than anticipated now, probably collapse in the summertime. So we probably need to take advantage of basis this winter. Because it'll probably be much weaker next summertime. The board, I think, carves out a broad low, and then it'll respond to weather come next summer.
His title is Chief Commodities Economist for INTLFC Stone. That's Arlen Suderman. Orion?
All right, Max, thank you for that visit. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, next week it's a 3.5-day trading week. All markets, Wall Street, stocks, commodities will be closed on Thursday for the entire day, and all of the markets will close at noon on Friday. But remember, Thanksgiving is a U.S. holiday, so other global markets will be open. We'll be back to take a look at where the markets will start next Monday when we continue on The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Didn't have enough to concern us in the marketplace, the Food and Drug Administration made an interesting announcement this week. Thursday, the FDA cleared the way for a type of genetically engineered Atlantic salmon to be farmed for human consumption, the first such approval for an animal whose DNA has been scientifically modified. 5 years ago, the Food and Drug Administration first declared the product made by a company based in Massachusetts, Aqua Bounty Technologies, to be as safe as conventional farm-raised Atlantic salmon. Aqua Bounty's product then will not require special labeling because it is nutritionally equivalent to conventional farm-raised Atlantic salmon, according to the FDA announcement. Aqua Bounty developed the salmon by altering its genes so that it would grow faster than farmed salmon and expects will take about 2 more years to reach consumers' plates as it works out distribution. The one interesting side note to that decision is the salmon can be produced only in 2 countries, in Panama and in Canada, and it must be confined to separate tanks for its production. And one of the things that Aqua Bounty says is important, the fish does a better job of converting the feed to protein. And that's one more way to help feed the world. But already the social media is filled with people who are disagreeing. So that means a battle over whether the U.S. government should require special labels for GMO foods is set to heat up again. Activists who argue that the farm-raised salmon poses risks to the environment and public health says its clearance by the Food and Drug Administration will galvanize opponents to press for the fish to be labeled as genetically engineered. Well, you know already where I stand on GMO, and one of the reasons for that is when I ask people who are anti-GMO why and do they know what a GMO is, 90% of the time I get a blank stare and no answer to my question. And so we still, I guess, are watching opponents to GMO labeling, and those opponents are saying it's GMO, so it has to be bad. I come back to the point, when are we going to start trusting science? Because we've been consuming GMO food products for 30 years. I have yet to see a death certificate anywhere that says death caused by consuming GMO food. But it's going to continue the controversy, and the labeling issue will be in the forefront once again. As we look at where the markets closed this week, live cattle futures lost modest ground today amid caution ahead of Friday's afternoon cash prices and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's monthly cattle on feed report. And so we're going to start the trade in the livestock futures at the Mercantile Exchange on Monday with the December live cattle contract standing at $129.62 a hundredweight after losing 27 cents in the Friday trade. The January feeder cattle contract will start trade Monday at $162.97 a hundredweight, and it gained 52 cents on this last trading day of the week. December lean hogs, pretty good bounce back again, up $2.25 for the day. It will start trade at $57.65 on Monday. What about the grain market? Well, we continue to face a difficult competitive challenge in the world wheat market. Wheat futures fell again today, pressured by the difficult export picture, but also by improving crop conditions in the winter wheat country, as well as the Midwest. Corn and soybeans dropped to end this trading day because of beneficial crop weather in South America. We are beginning to see prospects of a big increase in the corn and soybean stocks with the South American crop getting off to a pretty good start. For the wheat, soybeans shed only 0.2%. That's their fifth straight week of declines. Wheat futures dropped 1.7% this week, while corn gained 1.5%. So when we start the trade next week, this is where we'll find the prices. December wheat, we'll start the week at $4.88. That was a 3.5 cent loss today. December corn will start the week at $3.63 and a quarter, and that means that today December corn lost 0.75 cents. The January soybean contract dropped 2.25 cents today, so next week, $8.57 and a half. is where we'll start the soybean market. And as you heard Arlen Suderman earlier, he's not looking for much of a bounce back or much of a turnaround until after the first of the year, and then it's still going to be a very iffy situation. The Trans-Pacific Partnership took 8 years to hammer out the negotiations to come to an agreement, the 12 Pacific Rim countries finally doing that last month. But it took 8 years to get this far, and it'll probably take 1 or 2 years before we can even start trading in the Pacific Partnership, because each of the countries now has to approve. And on Capitol Hill, there's some opposition. But it's certainly not coming from former secretaries of agriculture, because this week they put out a public letter signed by Secretary Ed Schaefer, Mike Johanns, Ann Veneman, Dan Glickman, Mike Espy, Clayton Yeider, and John R. Block, all of them saying we need this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement because we're living in a global economy, and if we are not involved in these trading agreements, we'll be on the outside looking in while other countries will be involved in trade. That's our time for this week. As always, thank you for joining us on The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group.